headlines, Russian president orders a military to send peacekeepers in the two regions in eastern Ukraine after hours that he recognized them as independent republics. Ukraine says its borders remain unchangeable regardless of any action or statements by Russia as the U.S. Security Council holds an emergency meeting on the crisis. And people stage a sit-in in Gaza Strip to express support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Now, the big news on the Ukraine conflict. Russia recognizes the independence of two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine, accusing the Western-backed government of Kiev of committing genocide there.
We see that Kiev's leadership constantly says it does not want to abide the Minsk set of measures to solve the conflict. They are not interested in a peaceful solution. How long can this tragedy go on? How long can one endure it? In this regard, I consider it necessary to make a long overdue decision to immediately recognize the independence and sovereignty of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic.
In his speech, Putin demanded that Kiev immediately end military operations there or face responsibility for possible bloodshed. The announcement brought people to the streets and the breakaway regions for celebrations. In a decree issued shortly after the announcement, Putin told the country's defense ministry to deploy troops into the two regions under a peacekeeping operation. Moscow has yet provided no details or date for any deployment. Russia has already denied any plans to attack Ukraine or annex Donetsk and Luhansk. Meanwhile, Putin has also accused the West of cheating Moscow and dishonoring their promise to stop NATO's eastward expansion.
Today, we can only take a look at the map to understand how Western countries hold their promise to prevent NATO expansion to the east. They simply fooled us. We had five stages of NATO expansion, one after another. It has impacted very negatively on the nature of international relations and led to the loss of mutual trust.
Putin said he has information that the question of Ukraine's NATO membership is already decided, and it is just a matter of time. Putin said Kiev's admission to the alliance would pose a major security threat to his country, as this will multiply the danger of sudden strikes against Russia. Putin said the U.S. and NATO have fully ignored Russia's security concerns, and it requests for equal dialogue. He said Russia has now every right to take measures to protect its security, sovereignty, and values. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has reacted to Russia's decision, calling it a violation of his country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Russia's parliament is due to vote on Putin's recognition of the two regions on Tuesday. Russia's recognition of those two breakaway self-declared regions has sparked a tide of reactions worldwide, with unsurprisingly critical remarks and sanctions coming from the West. The U.S. President Joe Biden has signed an executive order to prohibit trade and investment with the two territories in eastern Ukraine. The U.K. is following suit, saying that it will announce significant and immediate new sanctions on Tuesday. The European Union described Russia's move as a blatant violation of international law, the territorial integrity of Ukraine, and the Minsk agreements. The bloc also vowed a unified and firm response, saying that it will target those involved with sanctions. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says the recognition is an ill omen and a dark sign that things are moving in the wrong direction.
It is becoming clear that we're going to need to start applying as much pressure as we possibly can, because it is hard to see how this situation improves.
NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg also condemned Russia's decision, accusing Moscow of seeking to stage a pretext to invade Ukraine once again. NATO members Poland and Latvia slammed what they described as the act of aggression against Ukraine and called for immediate sanctions. Canada and Australia have also pledged to respond with sanctions. Meanwhile, the UN chief scrapped his visit to Africa, citing the, quote, deteriorating situation regarding Ukraine. He says Russia's move is in violation of the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine and is inconsistent with the principles of the Charter of the United Nations. The UN Security Council has held an emergency meeting on Ukraine. In an address to the session, the United States branded Russia's recognition of the two breakaway regions as a pretext for war.
Russia's clear attack on Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity is unprovoked. It is an attack on Ukraine's status as a UN member state. It violates a basic principle of international law, and it defies our charter. What is more, this move by President Putin is clearly the basis for Russia's attempt to create a pretext for a further invasion of Ukraine.
Linda Thomas Greenfield called Russia's peacekeeping operation in eastern Ukraine nonsense. She said the consequences of Russia's action will be dire across Ukraine, Europe, and the globe. Ukraine's ambassador to the UN also addressed the meeting. He said that his country's borders remain unchangeable regardless of any action or statements by the Russian Federation. Russia, however, came out critical of the West's approach towards Ukraine, saying Moscow will not allow a new bloodbath in the breakaway regions.
We remain open to diplomacy for a diplomatic solution. However, allowing a new bloodbath in Donbass is something we do not intend to do.
Nebenzia said eastern Ukraine had been on the brink of what he called a new Ukrainian military adventure. He also warned Western powers to think twice and not worsen the situation. Meanwhile, China called for restraint by all sides to avoid further escalation. China's ambassador to the UN urged a diplomatic solution to the crisis. The Russian foreign minister has strongly condemned Israeli attack on the Syrian territory, warning that such raids risk a major escalation across the region. At a joint press conference with his Syrian counterpart in Moscow, Sergei Lavrov stressed the need to stop the Israeli aggression carried out in violation of UN resolutions. Lavrov also slammed the U.S. military presence in Syria, which he said blocks the government's access to resources and encourages separatist agents. Syria's top diplomat also noted that the U.S. military presence in northwestern Syria has displaced nearly 400,000 people. Faisal Mehrdad accused Washington of investing in terrorism to achieve its political goals. Mehrdad also described Israeli attacks in Syria as part of an attempt to protect the regime's terrorist allies. He noted that the raids are carried out every time the Syrian government makes headway against terrorist groups. The sixth summit of the gas exporting countries forum is underway in the Qatari capital, Doha. In an address to the session, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has slammed the U.S. sanctions on the oil and gas industry of some member states. Raisi called for further cooperation and collaboration among the member states to circumvent those measures. Raisi said collaboration among the member states can create stability in the region and that such an approach can bring about better economic conditions for all GECF members. The Iranian president noted that the Islamic Republic has a collective strategy for good cooperation. He said Tehran seeks to increase its export power. Raisi described natural gas as a clean source of energy, saying utilizing such energy can bring about major advantages. And on the sidelines of the gas exporting countries forum in Qatar, Iran's president has met with the Venezuelan foreign minister. During that meeting, Ebrahim Raisi hailed the resistance by Tehran and Caracas against the excessive demands of hegemonic powers. Raisi said standing against imperialism will surely lead to victory. He also hailed Caracas for overcoming sanctions with the support of its people. The Iranian president arrived in Doha on Monday, where he met Qatari Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani. The two sides signed over a dozen agreements and memoranda of understanding. And Palestinians in Gaza have expressed their solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails. Daily and weekly events are being held in the coastal enclave to boost the morale of prisoners. Ashraf Shannon has more.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip staged a sit-in to support Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. During the sit-in, people shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded the release of all Palestinian prisoners. Palestinian prisoners are political prisoners, and they are regarded as heroes and freedom fighters by all Palestinians.
The suffering of Palestinian prisoners has increased in recent months, especially following the Bold Escape operation in September. Prisoners, including women and children, suffer every day inside Zionist jails. The Zionist crimes against the prisoners must stop.
The sit-in comes at a time when hundreds of Palestinian detainees have been denied proper medical treatment in Israeli jails. Over 200 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli prisons since 1967. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Palestinian Ministry of Health condemned Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian prisoners, especially those suffering from chronic medical conditions.
For Palestinian inmates, Israeli prisons serve as gateways towards their death because of medical negligence. Currently, there are 700 very sick Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli prisons without proper medical care. Those sick prisoners are dying slowly as the world watches in silence.
Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers where they are denied basic human rights. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas demanded international protection for Palestinian prisoners.
We call on the Red Cross and all international organizations to help Palestinian prisoners, especially those who are sick in Zionist jails. We demand international protection for Palestinian prisoners. They are suffering because of the racist Zionist practices.
People here are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, there are thousands of Palestinian prisoners suffering in Israeli prisons under inhumane detention conditions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A probe conducted in Israel confirms that the regime has used the Pegasus malware to infect the mobile phone of an Israeli citizen subject to a court order. The probe, however, says the Pegasus system was not employed by police to infect mobile phones of citizens, as earlier claims by Israeli newspapers. But the Financial Daily in Catalyst says that the preliminary investigation requires a new check of the findings. Previously, Catalyst said that the police have hacked the phones of dozens of Israelis, including the son of a former Israeli prime minister. Pegasus is a malware product made by the Israeli firm NSO. It enables users to remotely activate the phone's microphones and camera and suck up the data inside. Now, Iran is hosting the fourth technology investment meeting of the D8 Organization for Economic Cooperation. The event is aimed at linking the markets of developing Muslim countries. Youssef Jalali reports.
100 domestic and foreign investors from Iran and 19 countries are in Tehran to take part in the technology investment meeting, or shortly, TIM 2022, a major tech investment event that aims to finance viable startups in the Muslim developing countries.
We are looking for tech-related startups, tech and IT-related, fintech, blockchain. So this type of business we are looking for, basically.
There's nothing that can limit Bosnia's business with Iran, and we attended the TIM today to boost our ties through science and technology parks of Bosnia and Iran.
Well, to be quite frank, there's this particular startup that I saw that presentation. I believe it was the second startup called NAPS, if I'm not wrong. Their idea is very, very unique. Their plan, their setup, their structure, everything is in place. I'm sure all the rest were as well, but this specific one caught my eye, and I believe I'd really like to take it further with them and to meet them in person.
Ahead of the physical meeting of the TIM, 120 virtual B2B meetings were held between venture capital funds, accelerators, and startups. During the TIM, newbie but promising businesses active in aviation, steel, health, and oil and gas signed MOUs with investors. totaling some $10 million.
We receive 167 plans from startups and companies. After some selection and some investigation, we filter them and finalize 61 projects and deliver these projects to our investors.
We know that Iran is under very heavy sanctions internationally, and it really makes life more difficult for Iranian startups for investing in Iran. So, as I was mentioning, Iran should try to arrange bilateral agreements internationally in order to be able to surpass this very difficult phase.
One of the major goals of the TIM is to boost commercial ties between the member states of the D8 Organization for Economic Cooperation. D8 stands for Developing Eight Countries, comprising Bangladesh, Egypt, Iran, Indonesia, Malaysia, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Turkey. However, investors from other parts of the world are also present at the two-day event.
The TIM offers an all-win opportunity for all participating countries, including Iran, since it is opening up a new multinational market that allows the Islamic Republic to trade without the need to wait for the removal of U.S. sanctions. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today we are going to touch upon the last parts of Imam Khomeini's testament where he addresses the Iranian nation. The Imam reminds the Iranian nation about the cost they have paid and the hardships they have endured to overcome the enemies and to achieve victory. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing the Iranian nation, writes in his testament that the pains and sacrifices are the cost for reaching lofty goals. He writes, "Once more, in the end of this testament, I make bequest to the Iranian nation that, in this world, the magnitude of tolerating troubles, pains, sacrifices, and deprivations are compatible with the magnitude of the goal and its value and lofty degree. What you, the noble and Mujahid nation, have reason for, have been pursuing in sacrificing your life and property, is the loftiest, highest, and most precious goal and purpose which has been and will be presented since the advent of the world till the end. And that is the school of divinity, in the broad sense of it, and the concept of monotheism with its exalted dimensions. The school of divinity and monotheism mentioned by Imam Khomeini has its roots in the belief that Allah is the only being who deserves to be worshipped. Imam Khomeini continues in his testament, "The school of divinity in its broad sense and the concept of monotheism with its exalted dimensions is the basis of creation and its ultimate point in the vast arena of being and the degrees and ranks of the unseen and the seen. And it has been manifested in the Muhammadan school in its full sense, degrees and dimensions, and all efforts of great prophets, greetings of God upon them, and the great friends of God, greetings of God upon them, have been made for that, and without that, it will not be possible to reach the absolute perfection and the infinite majesty and beauty. It is that which has made the inhabitants of the earth superior to the denizens of the ethereal heavens. And what the inhabitants of earth achieve in this journey will not be achieved by any creature in the whole creation, publicly or secretly." Imam Khomeini says that the Iranian nation is marching in the way of the divine prophets. He writes, "You, the Mujahid nation, are marching under the flag which is hoisted throughout the material and spiritual world. Know it or not, you are covering the way which is the only way of all great prophets, greetings of God upon them, and the sole way of absolute salvation. It is through this motive that all friends of God hog martyrdom and consider the red death sweeter than honey. And your youth in the battlefronts have drunk a sip of it and have become rejoiced. And it has been manifested in their mothers, sisters, fathers, and brothers. And we should truly say, we wish we were with you to achieve a great victory. May that soothing breeze and that zealous manifestation be sweet for them." Imam Khomeini explains that the spirit of devotion and cooperation ruling in the society is one of the manifestations of this sweet sense. He writes, "We should know that this manifestation can be clearly seen in hot farms, in breathtaking factories, in workshops, in centers of industry, invention and innovation, and among the majority of the nation in markets, streets, villages, and on all those who have overtaken these affairs to serve Islam, the Islamic Republic and progress and self-sufficiency of the country. And as long as this spirit of cooperation and devotion is there in the society, the dear country is, God willing, immune against every harm. And thank God, the seminaries and universities and dear youths of the centers of knowledge and education enjoy this divine unseen blessing." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, continues in his testament, "My bequest to all is to advance with Almighty God's remembrance toward self-recognition, self-sufficiency, and independence with all their dimensions. And undoubtedly God's hand is with you. If you be at his service and continue the spirit of cooperation for the progress and sublimity of the Islamic country, with the wakefulness, vigilance, devotion, self-sacrifice, and the spirit of resistance and resolve that I see in the dear nation in the way of truth, I hope that, through Almighty God's favor, these humane concepts will be transmitted to the posterior of the nation and every generation will enhance it." Imam Khomeini ends his testament with these words: "With a calm and confident heart, happy spirit, and an inward hopeful of God's favor, I take leave from the sisters and brothers and travel to the eternal abode while I am in urgent need of your good prayers. And I plead with God, the compassionate and the merciful, to accept my apology for coming short of service. And I hope that the nation will accept my apology for shortcomings and faults. They should go forward with power and resolve, knowing that with the departure of a servant, there will be no crack in the iron dam of the nation, as there are more superior servants at the service. And Allah is the guardian of this nation and the oppressed of the world."
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi is in Qatar's capital Doha in his first visit to a Persian Gulf Arab country. The 13th Iranian administration is keeping true to Raisi's campaign promise of enhancing ties with its regional neighbors. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why that is important for this administration. While there, Iran's President also spoke on the Vienna JCPOA revival talks, which will be another issue that we will cover with our guests. Well, let's talk with a journalist and political analyst. First, University Professor and Political Analyst Fouad Azadi will be joining us later. And Journalist and Political Analyst Elijah Magnier joins us from Brussels.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, Elijah, I'm going to start with you. We're going to have Fouad Azadi join us a little later. Looking at the Iranian president's visit to Qatar, I mean, this is an important trip. in itself, but it's the choice that he has made, the first Persian Gulf Arab country for him to visit. Why did he pick Qatar, and what was the reason behind it, that you think?
Thank you for having me. I think Qatar is very important because when Qatar was under the Saudi Arabia sanctions a few years ago, Iran was the first to give it a hand, support this, all the flights in and out, supply Qatar with everything that it needed, particularly when the Gulf country followed the Saudi embargo on Qatar. That's one. Second, Qatar is a very important country. It's playing a role between the West and the Middle East and the East. It has a very good relationship with Iran, and it has good relationship with the Gulf country and the Western country. So Qatar has an important role to play. However, we should not undermine the Iranian message, on the other hand, that Iran is and said already when President Raisi took power that is going to turn his back toward to the West and turn his face toward its neighbors in the first place and the East in the second place, which Iran takes us to this decision to establish excellent relationship with neighboring country. Saudi Arabia is still struggling to have an independent decision and walk toward Iran as Iran is doing so. And that will put the security of the Middle East and West Asia in the hand of the country of the Middle East. And Iran is offering a lot of new projects, particularly the Shahbar Harbor that is relating Eurasia with Turkey, Azerbaijan, Europe, Africa, and India, and has a lot to offer. So a good cooperation between Qatar and Iran can support the Middle East and the area and can really give an incentive to other countries to take a step away from the U.S. hegemony.
Well, when we take a look at this 13th administration headed by Ebrahim Raisi, true to his campaign promise, and as we have seen him putting it into action, he has made one of his number one priorities to be, if not the number one priority, to enhance enhance relations with regional countries. And he has made that part of his foreign policy plank. Why was that so important for Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, which we can see now with this visit that, you know, he's living up to his promise?
Yes, I think President Raisi has decided to adopt a complete different policy in his new government and in the 4 years of his ruling. The relationship with the West proved that it is irrelevant and it is not useful. It brought a lot of problems to Iran, and particularly when the West was not up to its promises, violated the JCPOA, and Europeans could not do anything to honor that signature. Therefore, it was important for Iran to say, okay, I'm going to look after my own economy, and I'm going to continue, but I will not depend on the West. I will not expect anything, and consider that the sanction will remain and look after the interests of my country without waiting for the lifting of the sanctions. So there is a lot of potentiality in the Middle East and in Eurasia, in China and in Russia, and this is why President Raisi established very important and significant deal with Russia and China, and now is turning toward the Middle Eastern country, particularly the Gulf country, to say, let us work together, and we can do it without depending on the West. So we see that President Raisi has established a plan, a roadmap for his government, and it is fulfilling it slowly but surely.
Okay, we have Fouad Izzadi with us now. Fouad Izzadi, I'd like to quote you what Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said while he was in Doha. He said, after several decades of aggressive and occupying presence of the arrogant powers, regional countries are now taking control of the region in their hands. Is this related to the fact that Iran's president has made establishing closer ties with the regional countries and enhancing those ties a basis for him to come out and say this?
You know, when he was running for presidency, this was one of the topics that he covered a lot, working more with Iran's neighbors, looking towards Asia, and not waiting for some agreement in some European capital. And that's what he has implemented. You know, Iran helped Qatar a lot when the Saudis and Saudi friends in this part of the world blockaded that country. The only route that was open was the northern route towards Iran. And Iran did this because Iran realized that if the Saudi government or UAE be able to bully others in this part of the world, then you'll face more difficulty as the time passes. And Qatar has realized the value of having close relations with Iran, and Iran does the same thing. And not only Iran and Qatar are neighbors, they share an important oil and gas field, and they can help each other a lot. And that's very much in line with Mr. Raisi's, President Raisi's foreign policy goals.
Well, we're going to get back to some of these issues, regional issues, security-wise, but I'd like to get to the statements he made, Elijah Magnier, on the revival talks that are happening in Vienna for the JCPOA, in which he says, Ibrahim Raisi said, the deal requires the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions, the protection of Iranian nation's interests, valid guarantees, and the closure of political cases. These requirements don't sound like there's anything new to it, but perhaps at this stage it's a reflection of Iran reiterating its stance, because as Iran sees it, the ball is in the court of not just the Europeans, but really the U.S. in particular. What's your reading into it?
I think Iran made it very clear that the JCPOA signed in 2015, either it is fully implemented or Iran needs to protect itself. And by protecting itself, because it doesn't want to go through another experience at 2018, when President Donald Trump revoked the deal unilaterally and imposed on his European partner not to deal with Iran. Therefore, Iran is saying, okay, well, I need a guarantee now that you're not going to do it again, but not only that you're going to respect the deal that you're going to sign and allow all the Western and all the other non-Western companies to deal with Iran and with the Iranian Central Bank and vice versa. Now, if this is not going to happen, Iran is going to take a step back and say, well, I'm going to keep some of my, there are points in the deals that Iran is working on right at the moment in Vienna to say, I need a backup and a plan B. And this plan B, until you prove United States and Europe that you're going to accept the deal, abide by it, respect it, and I want to see it implemented, and you return all the assets and the money that is frozen in different banks around the world, I am going to keep my advanced technology. I will not go to further than 60% enrichment uranium, but I'm not going to destroy my nuclear sites as Iran did with Iraq in 2015, 2016. So this is what Iran is negotiating. But what is important here is that Iran is negotiating from a position of power. And the reason why Iran is negotiating from a position of power, rejecting the presence of a U.S. flag in the room, a U.S. negotiator, refusing to talk to the U.S. Envoy, is because Iran is saying, if you don't do it in a way that I feel comfortable and the Iranian population are happy with the outcome, I don't care about the deal. You can keep your sanctions as they are, because they prove invalid and useless, because Iran did not submit to the Americans since 1979, and the sanctions are present and they are increasing and have reached their maximum. So the U.S. can no longer impose further sanctions on Iran.
Okay, Fouad Zaidi, I'm guessing that it's a balancing act, not for Iran, but some of the countries that Iran is establishing close ties with or closer ties with, when some of those countries have ties with the U.S., and they're rather strong ones. I mean, we know that Qatar is one of them. We know that Saudi Arabia, which Iran is in talks with, and perhaps some other countries. Does the fact that Iran, to make forays economically into those countries, mean that there will be a balance then when it comes to the relationship?
You know, Iran believes in countries being able to make their own foreign policy decisions. And Iran respects the independence of other countries. Qataris or other countries in this part of the world can have good relations with United States, Russia, China, whatever their leaders decide to do is not going to be something that Iran is going to be concerned about. What is missing in the past among some of these countries is that they put all their eggs in one basket. They become client states of the United States. And that is going to hurt them, as we see. And I think some of these countries are realizing that fact, that just following U.S. dictates is not a good foreign policy choice. And what Iran hopes is that these countries actually become more independent in their foreign policy decision-making. And if that happens, obviously, given the fact that Iran is a major country in this part of the world, both in terms of population, technology, other advances that Iran has made in the last 40 years, then Iran would be an attractive partner and neighbor to work with. And at the same time, these countries are welcome to have relations with others. And so what the problem has been is United States wanting to have a monopoly when it comes to countries in this part of the world, that they have to have good relations with the U.S. and then cut relations with countries like Iran or Russia and China. And that is what Iran is against. That is why Iran-U.S. relations are in difficulty, because Iran does not take dictates from Western countries, from the United States. And Iran hopes the same thing happens in this part of the world.
Well, I'd like to expand on this issue with you, if I may, Elijah Magnier, because as our guest, Fouad Zaidi, mentioned, some of these countries, and I think one of the ones at the top of the list would be Saudi Arabia, has realized, as our guest there said, you can't lay all your eggs in one basket. I mean, at this point, the U.S. President Joe Biden, I don't believe, even communicates with the Saudi crown prince, because I don't believe, based on what has been out there, reports that he believes that he is the one that is running the country, because he doesn't hold that title officially in terms of him being the ruler of Saudi Arabia. But my point being is that given that, and Saudi Arabia as an example, that maybe there's an alignment that is taking place here with these regional countries, leaving the U.S. out, and then for them to take matters into their own hands.
I don't think this has matured yet in the Middle East, and it takes time because the Gulf countries are very fragile because their ruling depends on the support of the United States of America and their military bases spread in the region. Therefore, the cooperation between countries of the region in the Middle East and the Gulf country in Iran, yes, that can be to a certain level. But I don't think these countries, at the exception of Iran, has the guts and the courage to stand against the U.S. So we saw that the Americans took a position from Mohammed bin Salman, but they've never stopped supplying Saudi Arabia with weapons, particularly to bomb Yemen. And they're still benefiting from their presence in Saudi Arabia and their military bases there. So I don't think this is going to happen now. And I think Iran is saying, well, you look at my experience since 1979 And today, I am in a position of strength, and I am negotiating with a superpower from a position of strength. This is no longer a superpower because the unilateral ruling of the world is falling down. It is a big power, and I was able to stand against it. So you can try to create a cooperation without necessarily being independent from the U.S. because you can't. And I don't think the Middle Eastern country are in a position today to work with Iran and take a step away from the U.S. because they need the U.S. protection. Donald Trump said it very clearly. Without us, you will fall in 1 week.
Right. But that could also be construed as, okay, then maybe we should do something about providing our own protection, and perhaps regional security can be established with regional countries. All right, there are two issues remaining here for this program that we have to cover. Fuad Zadi, Iran's president, talked about Yemen, that this is a humanitarian situation, an obligation. Lifting the siege has to happen for the oppressed nation, and that the Yemeni talks are the sole solution to the Yemeni crisis. If he's making those statements out of Doha and Qatar, does that send the message that perhaps Qatar could play a role in, or some kind of role in resolving the war on Yemen?
You know, generally the Saudis, whenever Iran talks about an Arab country, they become unhappy. They say that this is an internal affair, Arab affair. And Yemenis are Arabs. And for the last 6-7 years, the Saudis have been killing Arab women and children on a daily basis. So when President Raisi talks about Yemen in an Arab capital, he, I think, basically is pointing out to this fact that it's the responsibility of Arab countries to resolve this issue, given the fact that some of these countries, at least, don't like Iran to get involved in these matters. So if Iran decides not to be part of resolving that problem, then other countries, Arab countries, should engage in that. The unfortunate fact is that Iran has been one of the few countries in the world that has been able to have foreign policy that's independent from American pressure and support the oppressed people of Yemen and talk about the grave injustice that's going on there. And other countries, for one reason or another, have been generally silent about the atrocities that is taking place in Yemen. And what the Saudis have done, UAE also, is that they have actually increased Iran's influence in an Arab country by engaging in this reckless policy of trying to bomb their way and achieve a foreign policy goal by just killing innocent people in a country. And the hope is that they change course, they realize that they have made a mistake, and the sooner they do that, it's going to be better for them. Because continuing the current policy is a major failure, and it's going to cause difficulties.
Well, you had Raisi talk about the issue of Palestine, Elijah Magner, and that's my final question, saying that that's the main issue of the region. And Al Thani said that they stressed the need to stop the Israeli regime's aggression against the Palestinian people and obviously find a solution. How promising is that? Will Qatar play a role? It has, more maybe than some of his Arab partners or Arab countries, that other Arab countries. But do you think that they can play a more active role? Iran obviously does its best when it comes to the resistance of the Palestinians against the Israeli regime.
Well, there are many points here. First of all, Qatar is present already in Palestine and is supporting Gaza with, of course, the approval of the Israelis. And I think the Israelis are in a position of weakness here for several points. First of all, Yemen is picking up, and Ansarullah are registering more and more victories against the occupation of Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. And that frightened the Israelis because they consider the Iranians are sitting on Bab al-Mandeb. Secondly, it is in the advantage of the Israelis to accept any initiative coming from Qatar, because today the axis of the resistance, particularly Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and other groups, are becoming much stronger, and they are imposing deterrence on the Israelis, who feel weaker. And we saw that not only in the Sword of Jerusalem, but also throughout the recent month and recent weeks, how the Palestinians, they took control in hand, and they're threatening the Israelis,
okay,
who are being incapable today.
Okay, I'm sorry to have jumped in. We're just fresh out of time. That was Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst. Thank you for your contribution. Fuad Azadi, a pleasure, university professor and political analyst, spoke to us from Tehran. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahbahi and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, all over the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to focus on the doubts and misconceptions posed by different questioners all around the world concerning the Islamic issues. The question that we are going to talk about today is about the importance and value and excellence of istighfar, repentance, at the months of Rajab and Sha'ban. For this, we have invited an Islamic scholar from Qom Seminary Schools to join us in this studio and answer our questions. I'd like to welcome Sheikh Nur Muhammad into this show and say salam to him, Sheikh. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to this show.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure for us to have you here, Sheikh. Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, for accepting the invitation. And the question of the day that we need to talk about is concerning the Islamic medicine. You know, in this time and era that we are in, there are many different types of medicine and, let's say, practitioners and experts in different types and, let's say, branches of science in medicine. Muslims usually refer to some types of medicine entitled as the Islamic medicine. We want to see that if we have a sort of Islamic medication system or medicine that has been formulated in the format of a science, a branch of knowledge, do we have something like this? We have seen some books like that of Tibb al-Sadiq, for example, whatever the medical, let's say, recommendations that has been received from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Or we have many hadith and narrations from the Holy Prophet of Islam or the infallible Imams concerning different medical recommendations. So can we really rely on these recommendations and, let's say, instructions received by Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam and call it a branch of knowledge in medicine? And can it rely on itself to build a sort of well-structured science of medicine or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you again for this very valid question. Talking about Islamic medicine, you see that when we have a lot of hadith corpus or some verses of Noble Quran talking about the Islamic medicine, we cannot ignore these numerous verses of Noble Quran and the narrations of Noble Prophet and his pure progeny talking about Islamic medicine. You see, if you go to the divine religion of Allah, the religion of Islam, you see, you very obviously observe that we have Islamic medicine.
True.
And of course, these are all, maybe they are all raw materials that requires a lot of analysis, a lot of scholarly, you know, job that we have to do as a scholar, as Islamic scholars, you know, to do a lot of job on that, a lot of effort, you know, some kind of, you know, divisions of the narration, which we call it tabweeb, or doing many other scholarly work on these raw materials in order to have very formulated, you know, classical Islamic medicine. But after all, generally speaking, we have this Islamic medicine. And of course, this Islamic medicine, beside traditional medicine, by traditional medicine, I mean, for example, Iranian medicine, Chinese medicine, Indian one, or many other, you know, countries, they have their own medicine. But beside that, we have an Islamic medicine.
Yeah. Sheikh, are you talking about herbal medicine by your Islamic medicine, for example? Is it something that, for example, is it series of instructions on how to use the herbals?
Of course, some part of that is herbal one, but it is very much higher than that, more than that. You know, this Islamic medicine talks about, you know, prevention and cure. You know, all of that. And we have a lot of general ideas of Islam talking about, you know, different, you know, cure of different disease. You know, I mean, beside these prevention and general ideas, we have some, you know, particular and in detail cure for that, you know, disease.
So by whom has it been, let's say, formulated? Was it formulated by the Holy Prophet of Islam or the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, infallible Imams? So who were the founders of such branch of knowledge?
Of course, we are talking about Islamic heritage. This Islamic heritage, it has been created by the Noble Prophet and his pure progeny. And of course, beside that, we have, as I said, some verses of Noble Quran talking about this general indication of Islamic medicine. Let me share one part of some samples for this Islamic medicine. For example, we have Al-Himyatu Ra'sud Dawa, abstinence, and to be some kind of, you know, away from too much eating and drinking is best kind of cure. And if you, if you look at this, only one, this narration, if you check it with different, you know, physicians, they confirm this idea.
True.
That, you know, abstinence is one of the best cure and ways for the cure of the different kind of disease. For example, we have in different narration that you shouldn't eat too much. Khaffif min akilatik, which means to eat a little. While, of course, while you are hungry, you should eat a little and to, you know, chew it very well. And for example, when you want to go to sleep, relieve yourself before going, you know, to sleep. If you observe these two, these four recommendations about the eating and the etiquette of eating and etiquette of sleeping, we have in narration from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, he said, if you observe all these conditions, you do not need any physician. There is no more need for physician. Or, for example, we have Al-Mi'datu Baytudda. Stomach is the home for different kind of disease, emphasizing on the stomach. And the many diseases stem from this, you know, stomach. Of course, I can share a lot of other narration and verse of Noble Quran talking about Islamic medicine. But for sure, we have Islamic medicine, and it you know, it has a lot of recommendation and a lot of cure and prevention for the human being.